Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, November 26. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, blocking the Omicron variant at the border.
The government of Canada continues to take unprecedented and decisive action to protect the health and safety of all Canadians by introducing measures to prevent COVID-19 and new variants of the virus from being introduced and spread in Canada.
And Ottawa bans foreigners who have visited seven South African countries. Scientists warn the new variant could be the worst one yet. How concerned should Canadians be? And will this be enough to stop the variant from spreading through our country? We'll put those questions to the experts coming up. Plus, Prime Minister visits flood-ravaged BC.
We are now in recovery mode, and we still have dangerous weather ahead.
And with even more rain on the way, what is Ottawa doing to help the province recover? And what more do people in BC need to get back on their feet and rebuild? We'll get the latest on the ground straight ahead. And the first week of the new session now in the books. Were there any clear winners or losers in the first days back on the Hill? And with only a few weeks left before the Christmas break, how much can the government really get done? We'll have our plays and misplays of the week. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. A new potentially highly transmissible COVID-19 variant has people around the world on edge. The World Health Organization says the Omicron variant is a variant of concern. And today it sent markets tumbling and countries scrambling to block borders. Ottawa followed in the steps of several European countries in announcing new travel restrictions.
We are banning the entry of foreign nationals into Canada that have traveled through Southern Africa in the last 14 days. Southern Africa includes seven different countries: South Africa, Mozambique, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, Eswatini, and Namibia. Second, for all those that have arrived in Canada in the last 14 days, we are asking them to quarantine now and to go for a COVID-19 test.
Concerns over this new variant comes with the Canadian government moving to pass two of its key priorities over the next few weeks. The government is looking to keep healthcare workers safe from harassment and protests and give 10 days of paid sick leave to federally regulated sector workers. So, does our next guest have faith that this can get passed? And is the minority government ready to take on the Omicron variant? Let's find out. Joining me now is Labour Minister Seamus O'Regan. Minister, welcome to Power Play. Nice to see you. Thanks for being there on a Friday afternoon. I do want to talk about the legislation, especially in light of this new variant now, but I want to start with this Omicron variant. We know this is a variant of concern, so what is on the table to keep it from spreading here? We heard the Labour Minister saying we are banning the flights from seven countries. What else can be done?
So banning the flights from seven countries, which is in keeping, Joyce, with what other like-minded nations have been doing over the course of the day. The rest is really, you know, and I don't mean to pivot suddenly to the legislation that we passed today, but, you know, they do go hand in hand. It's taking the measures that we have learned over the course of the past, you know, 20 months. And, you know, looking for gaps that we found and locking and making sure that we fill those gaps. This is very much part of what we, you know, what we're planning on doing, which is with 10 paid sick leave days for workers across this country in federally regulated jurisdiction. So, you know, it's doing the things that we have been doing. It's following public health guidelines. It's making sure that we look after one another, look after ourselves, and that we get vaccinated, regardless of our workplace, regardless of where we are, that we get vaccinated. So those rules still apply. We will watch this, obviously, extremely closely along with other countries. But in the meantime, where there's any question, where there's any uncertainty, we have to take decisive action. And that is what you saw the health minister announce today.
Do you think that the federal government will encourage provinces, for instance, to put lockdowns again? Are you looking at possibly talking to the provinces? This may or may not be a dangerous variant. Are you talking to the provinces, and what are the provinces telling you?
My colleagues will most certainly be talking to the provinces, to talk about what we need to do. Right now, we know that we need to take a very careful look at who's coming in from countries of concern, which is, what the health minister was pointing to today. On my front, we are certainly going to be speaking to the provinces about what we will be doing with 10-day sick leave, and, how we can work with them to make sure that that goes through their jurisdictions as well. I mean, federal jurisdiction is about 6% of the workforce. The other 94% are under provincial and territorial jurisdiction. So just as we've done, throughout the pandemic, we will work hand in hand with provinces and territories because we're respectful of their jurisdictions.
So when you're talking about those 10 days of paid mm-hmm. sick leave for federally regulated workplaces, how many people are we talking about that don't already have paid sick days?
So there are 900,000 workers in these federal federally regulated jurisdiction. We're talking about some of the biggest companies and some of the biggest workforces in the country. Even though it represents 6%, you're talking about telecommunications. You're talking about air. You're talking about banking. You're talking about transport, the transport sector as a whole. So it is large. And of those, we know that about 63% do not get a full 10 days of paid sick leave. I mean, the fact of the matter is about 58% of the entire Canadian workforce doesn't get any paid sick leave. And you don't want people having to make the choice in a crunch. We know this from, I asked people in the press conference today to harken back to the spring of 2020. If you had a sniffle, do you come into work? If you were concerned at all, if you missed the symptoms, do you come into work? And for too many people, far too many people in this country, it was a decision that they had to make where they were weighing the health of themselves and of their colleagues at work with whether or not they could make the rent or pay for their groceries. And that is not something that, should be, even at the best of times. So particularly now that we're living with a pandemic, one of the reasons why we landed on 10 days is because, that's roughly two paid working weeks of 5 days each, 10 days, when you've got a 14-day quarantine. That's how we landed on 10 days.
That is a quarantine.
This has been driven by what we've learned over the pandemic.
But you also introduced new legislation to protect healthcare workers from harassment. And I'm interested in that one as well because, the right to protest remains, as the Justice Minister explained. This is only the protests that block people from entering a hospital. We've seen those shots. We've seen those protests. So how do you go about and do that without taking people's right away to protest?
Carefully define in the legislation, Joyce, obstruction and intimidation, right? There is nothing that taking away from anybody's right to peacefully protest. What we are saying is that when you obstruct healthcare workers from being able to do their jobs and when you intimidate them, that is crossing a line. And, we saw that line crossed over the course of the summer to the disgust, I would say, of millions of Canadians, including myself. That is not how we treat healthcare workers in this country. So we wanted to make sure that law enforcement officials had all the tools that they needed in order to make sure that they were able to do the job. And on top of that, frankly, I think we want to send a very clear signal to healthcare workers in this country that we got their backs, that this is not as a whole, the absolute vast majority of Canadians do not tolerate this sort of disrespect or intimidation of our healthcare workers, but most particularly with so many of them exhausted as we come out of this pandemic.
I know that I just have a few seconds left, but there are three mm-hmm. weeks left to this session. Very ambitious, four bills that you're hoping to get through the House and the Senate. How optimistic are you? Do you think these bills will become law by the end of the year?
I am, not going to get a step on the toes of the government House leader. I know, look, particularly when it comes to, the legislation that we introduced today on 10-day paid sick leave, ASAP, as soon as possible. And I think that there's, I think that there's a broad agreement in the House that we want to make sure that we support healthcare workers and workers right across this country. So watch this space is all I will say. And I'm glad we only have a few seconds left because I have to hold this phone up in order to make sure that we were able to do this interview at the last minute and my arm's given out.
Well, you did a great job, Minister. Thanks so much for being there. Seamus O'Regan, Canada's Labour Minister. Have yourself a wonderful weekend, sir.
Thank you, Joyce.
And returning now to concerns over the new variant, Canada's top doctors say it is something they are monitoring closely. Earlier today, Dr. Theresa Tam explained what makes this variant unique.
It is considered unusual in that it has a very high number of mutations in two key areas of the virus's spike protein. One area of mutations is in the spike receptor binding domain, where the virus attaches itself and invades our cells, which could signify a potential for increased transmissibility of the virus.
So that's the federal government on the Omicron variant, but what do the experts think? Are they concerned? And what does this mean for Canada's fight against COVID-19? Let's find out. Dr. Isaac Bogoch is an infectious disease specialist who sat on Ontario's COVID-19 vaccine distribution task force. And Dr. Amy Tan is a clinical associate professor with the University of British Columbia's Faculty of Medicine. She works out of the faculty's palliative care division. Doctors, welcome to both of you. Thank you for being there, and thank you for the work that you do when you're not with us. I'd like to, Dr. Bogoch, if you could explain in simple terms what Dr. Theresa Tam said about this new variant, and why are we concerned, and why should we be actually concerned about it?
So, okay, a couple of quick points here. I think it's fair to say that there are several mutations on this variant that might make this variant behave in a way that we would be concerning. I think it's also fair to say that we just don't know yet, that we just don't have enough information of how this behaves. We have the genetics, but we don't actually know how it actually behaves. But the key questions here are, is this more transmissible than, for example, the Delta variant? Does this cause potentially more severe infections? And does this somewhat evade immunity from vaccination or from people that have recovered from natural infection? Those are the key things. We know that the tests pick it up, so it's not a concern of how to diagnose it. We know our conventional diagnostic test, the PCR, will pick it up. But those are the three issues that remain unresolved at this point. And I think those are all answerable questions. We'll be able to get to the bottom of this in the days and, of course, in the weeks ahead.
So, Dr. Tan, the first thing the government did was react fast. We're going to close or ban the flights from seven African nations. We don't even know if this variant started in South Africa. We know that it was detected there in South Africa, right? So is it possible to protect a whole country from a variant like this coming in? And do we know that for sure we don't have it here yet?
And those are excellent questions and the questions I've been asking myself all day. No, we don't know to what extent this has been. We know that there was a specimen found from November 9th that had this. And yes, it was identified in South Africa, but who knows? And we know that there's been reports of people in other countries without any connection to South Africa who have now tested positive. So I think the travel bans are really an action that's almost performative. And it really actually detracts from the issue, which is global vaccine equity. We need to flood the global south with vaccines because this continues to be the problem. We know that this is a global pandemic. We have to take care of everyone, every country in the world with regards to the spread of this virus if we are to have any hope to get on top of this. It is the whole world that we need to take care of.
So, Dr. Bogoch, because you just asked the question and we don't have the answer to that, how effective are the two doses of vaccine that, you know, a majority of Canadians have gotten right now, by now? What about the booster shot? Is that another question? We don't even know. That would be your fourth question or unanswered question. We don't know if it would be effective against this variant. And are we looking at possibly more lockdowns down the road, or am I going too fast here?
Um, c- couple points. I think you're going too fast. But again, we always have to think about what the public health response is going to be. From a vaccination standpoint, this is pure speculation for a second. So total speculation. But I think it's very unlikely for a variant of concern to emerge that completely erases the benefit of the vaccine that we have. Listen, it might erode at some of the effectiveness of the vaccine, but it would be extremely unusual for the vaccines to be rendered useless just because a new variant emerged in one particular part of the world. So said another way, it's very likely that the vaccine still provides very reasonable protection. Of course, this is speculation. Of course, we need to do the right test to determine if that's true. And variant of concern or not, there already is room in many parts of Canada to expand eligibility to third doses. We should have been doing this in some parts of Canada, regardless of this news coming from Southern Africa. In terms of the other part of your question, you know, lockdowns and whatnot, listen, I think that's way premature. We already have the tools to keep this virus at bay. We know how to keep this virus at bay. We can vaccinate as many people as possible. That includes expanding first doses into the 5 to 11-year-old crowd. That means really working with adults who have not yet received a first and second dose. That means expanding eligibility to third doses. That means continuing with good ventilation in indoor spaces, wearing our masks, doing the things that we've been doing for a while now. And that's how we can keep Canadians safe. That's how we can actually keep this at bay.
Yeah. Dr. Tan, I'm curious, and I don't know if this is an answerable question. Now we know this variant exists. South Africa warned the world because they've got great detection methods. What do we need to know now, and how long does it take to be able to answer Dr. Bogacz's questions? In other words, is it more transmissible? Are the vaccines that we have, the various ones, effective? All those questions that, you know, non-epidemiologists such as myself would be asking right now. How do we find out, and how long does it take to know whether this variant is actually more transmissible and possibly more deadly?
So I think we need to be looking in the next couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, and see the different progression of this. As these first cases spread to others, what does it start looking like? And we only have about a week's worth of data. So we really, I do echo my co-panelists in saying we need to kind of hold back and just see what the data shows. We know that, you know, there seems to be a signal that it's more easily spread, but what that actually means in terms of consequence for infection and whether or not it evades immunity, those are things that we won't know with a little bit more time. And I don't think there's actually like a time frame. We just need to continue to track it. But I think I want to echo too, though, we have the tools here. And I would also say we need to be talking about the fact that COVID is airborne. We need to be getting good fitting masks, and we need to be using rapid tests right now so that we can actually keep this at bay. We need to do our part up in Canada, where we're very lucky to have vaccines, and we're very lucky to be able to do some of the things that make life a little bit more normal. But we need to do our part to make sure we contain this so that more variants don't have the ability to be created.
More rapid tests. Hear, hear, Dr. Tan. They should be more available. I totally agree. Dr. Bogacz, Dr. Tan, thanks so much for taking the time, for explaining these things to us. We're all just a little smarter thanks to you. Have yourselves a great weekend.
Thank you.
Be well. You too.
And still to come, will the situation in BC go from bad to worse?
We will receive between 90 and 120 millimeters of rain Saturday and Sunday.
The Prime Minister is meeting with the mayors of some of the hardest hit regions. We'll go to British Columbia for the latest. Next, stay with PowerPlay. And welcome back. Prime Minister Trudeau is getting a first-hand look today at the devastating flooding in BC. His visit comes as the province braces for even more rain on the weekend. So what more will Ottawa offer to help the province rebuild? CTV's Kevin Gallagher is in Victoria and joins me now. Kevin, good to see you. The weather doesn't look so bad there, unlike other parts of the province. What do we expect to hear from the Prime Minister?
Well, Joyce, thanks. It is a sunny day here. A brief reprieve for people in British Columbia who've really been getting pummeled by rain. Now, behind me, of course, is legislature here in Victoria, and Prime Minister Trudeau will meet with BC Premier John Horgan later this afternoon, and then they will hold a press availability. Now, it's not quite clear yet if there will be any major commitments, but certainly from speaking with people within the Prime Minister's office, there's going to be a willingness to have a commitment to work together to deal with the immense problems that will face this province as they try and determine what is going to be the price tag
and
here.
And while I'm interrupting you, I just want to let you know that as you're speaking, we're seeing pictures of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who arrived in Abbotsford, meeting with members of the Canadian Armed Forces right there. Go ahead, Kevin. About what we expect him to be saying once he meets with BC Premier John Horgan?
Well, I think what we're going to hear today is that Prime Minister Trudeau will have met with a lot of officials, as we're seeing right now in those pictures you're talking about, Joyce, on the ground in BC, where the flood has been so devastating for folks in Abbotsford, Sumas Prairie, and even further into the interior, all the way to Merritt. So, you know, this is something that I think Prime Minister Trudeau is going to hear a lot about what the needs are, what the scale of this damage is, and see it for himself. There's going to be, I think, right now, from speaking with officials within the Prime Minister's office, the issue, of course, is that because of the scale of this devastation, it's really not known what the price tag is going to be, how much this is going to cost. And also, just for example, to fix some of the issues on the highways that have been washed out by landslides, they're not only going to have to be repaired, but most likely repaired in a way that is more suited to a changing climate where more severe weather events like these atmospheric rivers are likely to occur. So, you know, they're going to have to try and climate-proof more infrastructure, to put it simply, or what's the point of fixing it up?
That's right. And, you know, there is more rain expected over the weekend. And this while they're trying to clean up and clean up the mud, Kevin Gallagher will be in BC on the weekend. He will be covering it for us. Kevin Gallagher, thanks so much for that. Stay safe.
Thanks, Joyce.
You know, now let's turn to another part of the province. Princeton, British Columbia, was hit hard by floods, and the town's mayor pushed hard to get military help to his community. The military has finally arrived to support the town, but now the province is bracing, as Kevin said, for more rain. So let's bring in Princeton Mayor Spencer Coyne to find out more. Mayor, welcome to Power Play. Good to see you, sir. Our thoughts are with you and your community. Give us an idea, if you could, an update of the situation right now in your town.
So right now we're preparing for not this weekend's atmospheric river, but the one that's heading our way. We expect it here Wednesday. I believe it's going to hit the coast by Tuesday. So Tuesday night, Wednesday for us. So we've got the Canadian Forces. They have 60 Reg Force assisting us right now in sandbagging efforts. We have two rivers that come together right on the edge of our town. So the whole town is surrounded by rivers. So their sandbagging efforts are to try to put those defenses in place around both rivers.
So I know that you last weekend you tried very hard to get the armed forces there, some soldiers there to help. Now they're there. How long will they be staying? And are you... do you think that what you have done now will protect your town from the expected rain you said midweek?
If they can stay as long as we need them, then I think we'll be okay. We've got a number of volunteers. We got more coming from out of town tomorrow to help with some of these efforts. So it's kind of a Herculean effort that we're undergoing right now. We're talking, you know, probably a few miles of sandbagging, and their assistance is vital to that. So I don't know how long they're staying. I don't know how long they've been deployed here for, but I'm hoping they can stay at least through the weekend and help us get those in place.
Oh, you mean that they're not all in place? So aside from the sandbagging, because I believe you've got two issues, the cleanup and then the preparation for perhaps some more rain and more flooding. So, how do you how do you balance the two?
We've got a number of different things happening right now. We're repairing infrastructure as fast as we can. We've got contractors that have been working to fill all the gaps in our dikes where we've had those blowouts. We have volunteers who have come into the community from the community that have come in, and they're helping people clean out their properties so that we can get all that stuff cleaned up before it drops to minus 20 here in a few weeks. And then on top of that, we're now sandbagging on top of the dike works that we've just rebuilt. So we are undergoing multiple different things at the same time. And for a town our size, it's a major operation. So everywhere you look in our community right now, people are working.
I can imagine. Yeah, the minus 20 thing, we hadn't thought about that. But that's coming as well. So the Prime Minister is in BC. He's meeting right now with the Mayor of Abbotsford. He's going to Victoria. He will meet with your Premier. What do you need? What do you need in your town, in Princeton? What do you need to hear them say to help you out of this?
You know, I think we need from the Prime Minister, we need a commitment that going forward and repairing, that the federal government is going to help us fund this. Rural British Columbia right now is the forefront. We're the front line of climate change in this country. Last summer, we watched as we literally lost communities last summer in forest fires. Now we're watching, you know, entire cities and communities be swallowed up by these rains. This is the front line of climate change, and the federal government, I need them to realize that and need them to help us build back. Right now, the funding formula is 80-20. We're really hoping the federal government's going to pick up that 20%. So small towns like ours, where we're looking at $10+ million, and now I've been told today we're looking at a re-diking program that could be upwards of between $30 and $50 million. There's no way 3,000 people can afford that. So I need the federal government to understand and realize that rural British Columbia is the front line of climate change, and we need their help in paying for this.
Well, Mayor, I hope that the federal government in Ottawa hears you. Wish you luck, and our thoughts are with you as you brace yourself for some more rain this week. Sir, thank you. Thank you for being on Power Play, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you. Anytime. Have a good day.
And coming up, Parliament made its long-awaited return this week. Did the first back set the tone, the first week back, rather, set the tone for the new parliamentary session, or was it a return to the so-called toxic Parliament from last spring? Our Friday panel of strategists will dig in next. Stay with us. We'll be back after these breaks. And we are back. The pandemic is still top of mind for many Canadians, especially after today's news about a new variant of concern. But the pinch in people's pocketbooks is also emerging as a concern for Canadians as prices at the pump, at the grocery store, and in the housing market soar. When the new parliament made its debut this week, Conservative MPs came out swinging over the high cost of living. The Tories are linking unprecedented government pandemic spending to the historic rise in inflation. But is this line of attack a distraction from the Conservatives' own internal party divisions? And is it a right one? Or will it be a winning strategy as Canadians struggle with the surge in prices? Let's bring in our Friday panel of strategists to weigh in. Greg McEachern from Proof Strategies leans liberal. Kate Harrison from Summa Strategies Canada, who is also a conservative strategist. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Weston from Earnscliffe Strategy Group is a non-partisan perspective. Hello, strats. Happy Friday. Nice to see you. I'm going to start with you, Anne, because I'm curious about this. This was supposed to be the most important election campaign since the Second World War. This was not going to be a toxic parliament. First week happened. What did you think about the tone and the question and the tone in the House and during question period?
Well, first of all, let's put it this way. It was not a slam dunk that there was a need to have that election. I think everybody kind of understands that that was not necessarily needed, and the results would show that not much changed in that sense, although important issues, of course, were discussed. I don't think I agree that the tone prior to the election was toxic. I think it was an excuse that was used to trigger an unnecessary election. And I don't think that having disagreements in the House of Commons based on the particular political philosophy and your constituents and the party that you come from means that there's a level of toxicity. I think it is there is a government, and the opposition parties have a different perspective than the government, and they need to be able to put that perspective out there. That doesn't mean that the government can't get things done. It doesn't mean that there aren't times when parties can agree on things, but it does mean that there is a level of debate and argument that takes place in the House of Commons, and that is normal.
And Kate, let me ask you, because the Conservatives came out strong on inflation this week, cost of living. It is clearly top of mind for Canadians, and it's clearly obvious if any of us have gone to the supermarket to buy food. But is it fair for the Tories to blame inflation on the government pandemic spending when, you know, really all the parties voted in favor of pandemic support, even the Conservatives? Is it the right sort of strategy?
Well, pandemic spending is only part of the equation. Canada's finances were not on the right track even before the pandemic emerged. So certainly there's room to discuss the scope of the support that was provided, how long it went on for, could it have been better targeted? But I think now what Conservatives are saying is, okay, we know we're going to need to live with some version of COVID for a long time. So what's being done to try and rein spending a bit further under control? And I actually think the Liberal government should get some credit here in terms of how they are choosing to direct their support programs at this point. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a check and balance on all of the other spending that the government has done to date or what they plan to do in the future. So I do think that the Conservatives are right to focus on this. We're seeing through public opinion data that cost of living is the number one issue. It's eclipsing things like healthcare, like climate change and other big priorities. And people are really feeling the pinch and the consequence of government spending without being reined in. So I think the Tories are right to focus on that because it is what people are talking about.
Definitely. Greg McCachran, let me ask you, because in the throne speech, you know, the government highlighted the $10 a day childcare deals with the provinces, the plan to create more affordable housing. That's a way, according to them, to tackle affordability. But it's not going to happen overnight. This, we're talking, you know, years in the making for these kinds of solutions. So are the Liberals, are they seen as trying really to tackle or to understand even that this is the price of groceries, this is the price of everything, gas, and yes, indeed, childcare will help, but is this the right way to tackle it?
Well, I guess you would have to compare the Conservative approach. The finance critic for the Conservatives seems to blame Justin Trudeau for worldwide inflation. And, you know, it's not a laughing matter if you're, you know, a family trying to handle the cost of living, but it just doesn't make sense. And it doesn't, you know, putting Pierre Poilievre in as finance critic may have made, you know, Erin O'Toole, given him a little bit, of help in his caucus issues. But it doesn't make sense. Canada's inflation rate compared to Mexico and the United States, we're much lower. We're right in line with the average of the G20. What I think the government can do is things around the Port of Metro Vancouver, the damage that was done due to the recent weather, and I know that there's some scary weather coming again. You know, there are British Columbia MPs who are, you know, some of them Conservatives, calling on the government to do more. That is something around supply chains that the government can do. We've learned a lot about supply chains during the pandemic. But if we have a big issue at the Port of Metro Vancouver, it is going to affect the entire country. The government needs to address that. Yeah. But some of the things that the finance critics said this week just kind of didn't make sense and were almost funny.
I'm not sure about that. But Greg Weston, so is it fair? Yes, the inflation is caused by perhaps the supply chain issues. But is it fair for the Conservatives, although it works really well, to ask the Prime Minister if he knows the current price of chicken or bacon or, you know, and we've heard that question before. Susan Delacorte in the Toronto Star had a great column on that, on how which prime ministers and which leaders were asked for the price of milk and food and so on. It's an interesting tactic, but is it fair? And how many prime ministers would really know how much a chicken costs and how much bacon costs and how much, you know, a liter of milk costs?
Well, I'm not sure how fairness snuck into the lexicon of the House of Commons. we're kind of fading into territory here. Don't let the truth get in the way of a good bumper sticker. I think that most Canadians, yes, are seized with this, which is why the Conservatives are seized with this, because they know this will resonate with Canadians. And if you can blame it on Justin Trudeau, go for it. That's all part of politics. Reality to this, Joyce, the Bank of Canada is predicting that we will return to about 2% inflation, which is back to what we had come to think of as normal by mid next year. I think everybody knows, if they stop and think about it, that the pandemic has created shortages in supplies all over the world. And as you say, supply chain problems. We have supply chain problems now coming in from the West Coast. We have you can't unload the tankers there or the big ships carrying goods to the country. Look, you can't blame the Conservatives for wanting to make mud while the rain's coming down. It's not gonna last a long time. Frankly, you know, Greg is right. If you actually look at the consumer price index, which I did before we're coming on here. This big spike in rising costs right now, a lot of that is making up for the fact that 2020 prices were completely flat. If you put the two of them together, not much has happened. We've continued to grow at prices at about 2.5 to 3% a year, you know, with the exception of things crazy like gasoline at 40%. But, you know, this is what Canadians are worried about. And if they're worried about it, then the opposition parties will naturally turn that into a hammer.
And it is a real worry. I mean, it really is happening. These prices are really going up. But I have 2 minutes left, and I'd like to hear the four of you on this. There are four bills that the minority Liberal government is hoping to pass before the end of this session. So very quickly, because seriously, I think we have a minute to go, I'm going to start with you, Greg McEachran. Can this happen?
It can happen, but we're forgetting that the Senate is going to play an important role here. And things can go fast through the House of Commons. They may not go as fast in the Senate.
Kate Harrison.
I don't think it's going to happen. I think we might see half of those get through. The Senate very well could play spoiler. And it doesn't seem as though the government is keen to negotiate right now with the NDP or the Bloc, and certainly not the Conservatives. So I give it about a 50% chance success rate.
And what do you think? Is it possible?
So I think it could be possible. Some of them should have passed in the last parliament. So conversion therapy, paid sick days, all of those kinds of things. And instead of playing cynical games with those, they should have pushed those forward and got them done last time. They're necessary. They should happen. I think it is possible to get some of them done at least.
Greg Weston, what do you think? Is it possible? Four in 3 weeks.
Well, anything's possible if the parties see it to be in their interest to pass them, Joyce. So I think the ones that directly affect individuals, like the paid sick leave and the COVID-related bills, will probably get passed. The other ones, it's a toss-up whether the opposition feels like letting them through. Yeah. And then, of course, we have who knows what they're going to do.
And the good thing about that is that we will know in 3 weeks. Greg McCachran, Kate Harrison, Anne McGrath, and Greg Weston, thank you. Thanks for being there. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next Friday.
Thanks, George.
You.
And coming up, Parliament is back, and so is our plays and misplays segment. What was a hit and what was a miss? Our press gallery panel will weigh in next. Stay with us. And welcome back. The first week of this parliamentary sitting comes to a close, so who came out on top and who didn't? The return also kicked off a contentious debate about the hybrid parliament. So with MPs finally back in the House, what are the plays and misplays of this week? Let's ask the press gallery. CTV News Online politics producer Rachel Aiello is also the author of CTV's News Capital Dispatch newsletter that I recommend you read. It's really good. And Laura Stone is a reporter with the Globe and Mail's Queen Park Bureau. Nice to see both of you. Happy Friday. Rachel, do you have a play or a misplay?
Joyce, I have a misplay this week, and it's to all parties involved in the hybrid sitting debate this week. I watched most of it, and I have to say, Joyce, I have a bit of whiplash from the back and forth, confusing and contradicting statements from each side. You know, you had the Liberals say, well, it's still not safe. There is still a pandemic. We need to do this. But it was safe enough to have an election. The Prime Minister's gone to a few international summits. Oh, and we need to do this very quickly, because we have a limited window of time in the House. Well, you called the House back 2 months after the election. And then on the other hand, we had the Conservatives and some of the other bloc MPs saying, well, you know, we're in a different COVID situation. It's safe. Meanwhile, Conservative MPs still haven't been transparent about who among them may still be unvaccinated. And Aaron O'Toole, you know, saying this was about accountability and hiding. But meanwhile, he walked out of a press conference this week. So in terms of the first big debate in the House, I would say to all of them, do better.
Laura Stone, okay, what can you add to that? I mean, you followed it from Toronto. Was it a misplay, a play? What do you think about that?
Well, look, I think, you know, the broad public agrees primarily with the hybrid model. I think a lot of us have been working from home when we can, going in maybe a few times a week, but I don't think it's generally accepted among most people, unless you're in the TV business where you have to be in every day, Joyce, where people are comfortable fully going back to work. So I do think the Liberals have a bit of an advantage in that respect. Rachel brings up some very apt points regarding the Prime Minister's own travel and some of the decisions that the Liberals have made. But I think when it comes down to it, I mean, you know, just look at the news we're seeing today regarding the variant of concern and people still worried about COVID numbers rising and such. I do think there's more of a broad support for this hybrid model than there is for pushing everyone back to the office. And that includes the MPs in Parliament.
Rachel, you know, the NDP MP Laurel Collins brought her baby on the floor to make the point that virtual parliament allows her to keep working if she needs to stay in her riding with her baby. It was really effective. The image was effective of this woman holding her baby on her hip and, you know, making that argument. You know, could this be the future for parliament to make it, you know, accessible for different people who are running for office?
Yeah, I understand the conversation wanting to be had about making hybrid a permanent thing to make it more accessible. But I would note she did make that point in the House. There are changes that have been made over the years to allow for the physical House of Commons itself to become more accessible and open to young parents, other diverse groups. And so I think it would be remiss if at least we don't have a conversation about, instead of just let's all hop on Zoom, how do we update and modernize the House of Commons in person to ensure that it is a welcome place for more folks.
Interesting. That's true. Point well taken. Laura, you have a play or a misplay today?
Joyce, I have a play of the week, which is the new travel restrictions that were introduced today by the Liberals. I think this is the only really politically palatable thing that the government could do, and it's broadly supported from all sides. We heard from premiers today in Ontario and Alberta. We heard from the opposition parties also pushing for this. And I think that the Liberals have learned throughout this pandemic that quick, decisive action in the absence of all of the information is what the Canadian public is looking for. Of course, it's not a solution to everything. Of course, there are a lot of unknowns. It doesn't replace vaccine equity, for instance, in African nations. It doesn't replace public health measures. It doesn't replace testing and surveillance. But I think it's one of the tools in the toolkits that the Canadian public wants to see. And when there's concerns like this around the world, and there are certainly a lot of unknowns right now, I think that people want to see something happen faster than we've previously seen in the past.
And you know, Rachel, the government was criticized a lot at the beginning of the pandemic for not having reacted fast enough to close borders and so on. I have 1 minute left. They reacted really fast. Is this more of a political reaction, or was it more of a scientific, or answering, you know, a scientific reaction, so to speak?
Probably a bit of both, Joyce, right? We've got a new minister in the health portfolio, so perhaps he wanted to do things differently or has a different style than his predecessor. But also, we've had past variants where we saw the government not act this quickly. I know I saw the news this morning and was wondering right away, well, okay, are we going to hear from them today that they're looking into this, they're on it, and then, you know, cases are going to show up, and they would be slower to act than they were. So I agree with Laura. I was pleased to see that them take this decisive action. And to your question, Joyce, I think it is a matter of both learning their lessons from past variants and potentially new leadership in that health portfolio.
Rachel Aiello, Laura Stone, that's all the time we have for the plays and misplays. Interesting, we brought that back. I like that. thanks for being there. Have yourselves a great weekend.
Thank you, you too.
Thanks.
And that's your Power Play A Day in Politics. Thank you for watching. Have a wonderful and safe weekend. We will be back right here, same place, same time on Monday. Bye-bye.